Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
On a personal note, it's painful for me to know that nearly every death we are seeing now from COVID-19 could have been prevented. I say that as someone who has lost 10 family members to COVID-19 and who wishes each and every day that they had had the opportunity to get vaccinated.
Over the last many months, we've learned a lot about COVID-19, including how to stop it. Yet the virus is rearing up again in dangerous ways as vaccinations lag and disinformation spreads. It's a dangerous combination that we'll discuss this morning with the U.S. Surgeon General, who you just heard there. Plus, we'll go live to Mississippi, where health officials are warning of a surge in the Delta variant. It's landed several children in the ICU, some on life support. Also, an exclusive excerpt from that bombshell book by a pair of renowned Washington Post reporters, how Bill Barr reportedly stunned Donald Trump into silence. Think about that, with his warning about the 2020 election. We'll get to that just ahead. Plus, Angela Merkel pays her final visit to the White House as Germany's chancellor. We'll talk about her meeting with President Biden, which, unlike a summit with Bush 43, did not include any spontaneous shoulder rubs. Surprised about that. All that and much more on this Friday, July 16th. Willie, that Bush-Merkel shoulder rub never gets old. It never gets old.
A little shoulder rub diplomacy from the 43rd president of the United States. We'll talk much more about Angela Merkel in a moment, but we do begin with the growing fears of a new COVID wave as cases climb, vaccination rates plateau. Now, the nation's largest county, Los Angeles, is turning back the pandemic clock, issuing a new indoor mask mandate. NBC News correspondent Miguel Almaguer has the latest.
Los Angeles, the nation's largest county, taking a step back, requiring masks indoors, even for the vaccinated effective Sunday. Impacting 10 million people here and breaking with CDC guidance, it's a clear signal concern is growing over the highly contagious Delta variant. Meantime, for some of the 48 million children under 12 and their parents who were hoping to get them vaccinated this fall, a longer wait. The FDA will now review several additional months of safety data, meaning a vaccine for kids won't likely be available until early next year.
It makes it a very stressful time to be a parent, an educator, and a child. All schools should really have very strong contingency plans. What are the metrics by which we would go back to virtual learning? What will we do to keep children and staff safe?
While more than 4 million children have contracted COVID, less than 2% have been hospitalized, and only a small fraction have died.
But now our nation is bracing for a tidal wave of new infections, as experts fear a new flood of COVID cases is just beginning to grip the country.
We've exceeded last year's peak.
While outbreaks were expected in unvaccinated pockets of the nation, 98 million are still not inoculated. 40 states are seeing a rise in infections. At Yankee Stadium, positive COVID tests forced the game against the Red Sox to be postponed. The Delta variant, a serious risk.
It's going to find those pockets in each community where people aren't vaccinated, and it's going to do a lot of damage.
That damage being done. And for the unvaccinated, including the youngest Americans, the worst may still be to come. Miguel Almaguer, NBC News.
We should point out CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky reiterated yesterday her agency is not recommending people who are fully vaccinated wear masks. Let's bring in one of the experts we saw in Miguel's report, physician and fellow at the Brookings Institution, Dr. Kavita Patel. She's a former Obama White House health policy director and an MSNBC medical contributor. Dr. Patel, it's good to see you this morning. This is gut-wrenching. It's frustrating, obviously, given all we've been through, all the work that's gone in to get us to this place. How do we change this trajectory we appear to be on right now?
Yeah, Willie, one word, vaccination. I think that it's incredibly clear that the vaccines that we have are effective. And what we're trying to do, I won't even call it herd immunity. It's confusing to say that. What we're trying to do is just reach a goal where the majority of people, not 100%, because we are going to have kids and people who can't get vaccines for different reasons, but where the majority of people are vaccinated and it protects the unvaccinated. This is a simple kind of epidemiology, public health 101. Short of that, Willie, we're going to continue to see these rolling waves throughout the country in various pockets. Larger numbers in some areas, but don't think that just because you live in a part of Connecticut, Vermont, or another area of the country, Southern California, where if you have an area that's highly vaccinated, that the people who are not vaccinated are still not susceptible. Let me say it another way. Everybody is vulnerable at some point. And I will just take a difference with the CDC director. Obviously, she's much more kind of in the data than I am, but there's no harm in talking about highly risky settings, high risk settings like indoors where multiple people who are not vaccinated might gather with vaccinated people and just having everyone follow the same rules. Because what we're seeing right now, Willie, is that people aren't doing it. We're kind of trusting everyone. And I don't see a reason to do that.
Do you think, Dr. Patel, that Los Angeles County is kind of a leading indicator of where places across the country may be headed? We know about the states with low vaccination rates, many of them across the South, but you mentioned the states that have done well in terms of vaccination, Connecticut, the Northeast, New York, Massachusetts, Maine, up and through the New England area. Are those places susceptible now to rollbacks in terms of the kind of restrictions we might see?
They are. And let me just say, even more than Los Angeles County, by the way, I really do praise the public health officials there. They're sticking their necks out on the lines. They're not popular people these days. But I would say we can look to other countries. We can look to Israel. We can look to parts of what the UK has had to do. Ignore what Boris Johnson has said, but look at what local public health officials and Ministry of Health officials are doing on the ground there. Australia, other parts of the EU, they are kind of what we would call canaries in the coal mine. They have put back in indoor masks, and it's simply for this reason. Vaccines do protect us. They protect us from hospitalization and death, as we've said. Unvaccinated people with a variant, Willie, that is novel, that we don't understand, that is highly transmissible, mm-hmm. highly infectious, minute to give it to each other. What is the harm when you're with strangers to wear a mask indoors, especially in close contact settings? Why are we taking a risk that we don't need to take when we have a very simple preventive measure for now? Until we get more people vaccinated. And that's really the bottom line.
So, Dr. Patel, given what you just said and the simplicity of it, because science is about facts, but health is about communication and is about helping a population understand what's best for them to live long, healthy lives. What is happening here? What is the predominant reason that people are not getting vaccinated? What are you hearing?
Yeah, I'm a primary care physician, so I'm hearing a lot of different things, including large sources of misinformation. I think that's why you're talking to the Surgeon General. Number one, people have the amount of misinformation has outweighed the facts and the science. I may be the only person in a 15-minute visit telling people about what the facts on in the data and the journals tell us, but I've got 99.9% of people's lives dominated by Facebook, WhatsApp groups, and commonly kind of now the myths unfortunately seem like facts, that this interferes with your DNA, that it affects your fertility, that it can affect future pregnancies, that the government rushed this and that this is a conspiracy to help pharmaceutical companies. I've heard it all. I don't think there's one mm-hmm. piece of misinformation I haven't heard, including, you know, that this causes you to become magnetic. And what I've learned, Mika, over months, you can't shame them. You cannot blame them. You have to actually kind of start and empathize and say, yeah, you know, I too thought this might be kind of fast. And here's what I've learned. And here's why my 28-year-old Latina patient did want this vaccine, because she saw her sister get hospitalized and become dependent on oxygen at her age. So I think it's a very different, honestly, Mika, it's what we had to do 10 years ago to fight misinformation about the Affordable Care Act, right. about access to health care. So it's just, it's different misinformation in different forms, but exploited by multiple media channels and multiple opportunities.
Well, absolutely important not to shame or blame the people who have been misinformed. That would be wrong. But the leaders, especially the Republicans and those who funnel Donald Trump and Donald Trump himself, choosing to be negligent, choosing to misinform people, maybe even media organizations, choosing to have hosts that misinform people. That is choosing to be negligent. That is malpractice, and that is on them. And it will be what happens to this country on them. Here's the warning, and this is just so chilling. The warning that the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, issued about misinformation when it comes to COVID-19. Dr. Murthy released a Surgeon General's advisory yesterday declaring the rise of misinformation online an urgent threat, calling on social media companies to take action.
Today, we live in a world where misinformation poses an imminent and insidious threat to our nation's health. Modern technology companies have enabled misinformation to poison our information environment with little accountability to their users. They've allowed people who intentionally spread misinformation, what we call disinformation, to have extraordinary reach. They've designed product features, such as like buttons, that reward us for sharing emotionally charged content, not accurate content. And their algorithms tend to give us more of what we click on, pulling us deeper and deeper into a well of misinformation.
All right. And as we played at the very top, it's worth repeating from the Surgeon General, nearly every death from COVID-19 that we're seeing now could have been prevented. Think about that. At that same briefing, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that a large amount of misinformation is being spread by a relatively small number of people.
There's about 12 people who are producing 65% of anti-vaccine misinformation on social media platforms. All of them remain active on Facebook, despite some even being banned on other platforms, including Facebook, ones that Facebook owns.
Following those remarks, Facebook put out a statement reading, "We've partnered with government experts, health authorities, and researchers to take aggressive action against misinformation about COVID-19 and vaccines to protect public health. So far, we've removed more than 18 million pieces of COVID information, removed accounts that repeatedly break these rules, and connected more than 2 billion people to reliable information about COVID. Are you really taking credit, Facebook? You're taking credit? You think you saved lives? Because the bottom line is, as long as you are carrying, channeling, and pushing out misinformation, that's taking lives, not saving lives. The Surgeon General will be our guest a bit later in the morning, Willie. It's just so frustrating that these companies that are really fire hoses of bad information and people who are following Trump and the leaders in Washington who refuse to bow to Trump, who are really delivering misinformation and using Facebook and social media and anywhere that will listen to spread disinformation. There are a million words I can think for it, but at this point, it's fatal. It's killing people.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It is. It's deadly what's happening right now. And of course, the seeds of all this disinformation, this bad information, were planted a long time ago, long before the last year and a half around coronavirus. But yeah, Now we're seeing the rotten fruit, and it's costing lives. Dr. Patel, it does feel like we've had all the trusted partners and people like you and others have worked so hard to get the message out to communities that have not been vaccinated. It feels like we've hit a ceiling. And if that's true, and if we maybe change the numbers on the margin and they go up a little, but not enough to get us where we need to be, what happens in the next few months, the next year with coronavirus in this country? What does it look like to you?
Yeah, Willie, look, I think you're asking the critical question that all health officials are. And I'll say, number one, I hope there will be an uptick in vaccinations, especially as schools open. The news that we're not going to have children's vaccines option kind of in the near future should give many adults, even those who are completely skeptical, at least some pause. And I'm hoping school officials kind of encourage adults to get vaccinated. So that's one hopeful piece of good news. Number two, I do think employers, you've heard many large employers say that, and big ones, small ones, and medium-sized ones say they want to bring employees back in by Labor Day a little bit more fully and kind of enforce. They are going to have a heavier hand for having their workforce vaccinated, Willie, whether that be through requirements or mandates, or to say that if you come and you are not vaccinated, we are going to ask you to do all of the following precautions And quite frankly, we do this in healthcare. We make it so onerous that it really is easier to try to get vaccinated. Full approval of those vaccines for adults will certainly hopefully help that. I think the third thing is getting the world vaccinated. I can't stress this enough. You look at other countries, Indonesia, where it is literally spiraling out of control. India, where they really never recovered from that deadly second wave. South America, where we see the Lambda variant, and Peru, responsible for about 93% of the infections. Willie, perhaps the best thing we can do is to say, all those vaccines we're not going to use, we're going to help to be part of a global kind of vaccine push. The president has expressed this, but we can't do it soon enough. So the next year is going to look like these, just literally, just like heat waves, Willie, rolling heat waves across the country back and forth until people are either vaccinated or infected.
It's just incredible. Dr. Kavita Patel, thank you so much. And coming up, we have a lot more on this. We're going to take you inside a Mississippi hospital where there are children on life support, going into a hospital in Arkansas. Bottom line, this thing is real. It's coming back in these United States of America. We have a pandemic among the unvaccinated, and we'll have a lot more coming up. Turning now to politics, we have more this morning from the upcoming book by Washington Post reporters Carol Lenig and Philip Rucker, entitled I Alone Can Fix It, Donald Trump's Words. This latest excerpt recounts former President Donald Trump's reactions to the January 6th Capitol attack. Reading from the book, quote, early on January 6th, Trump called Pence, who was spending the morning at his Naval Observatory residence before heading to the Capitol. Pence again explained the legal limits on his authority as vice president and said he planned to perform his ceremonial duty as prescribed by the Constitution. But Trump showed him no mercy. You don't have the courage to make a hard decision, he told Pence at 2:10 p.m. The first rioter entered the Capitol by breaking a window and climbing inside. A stream of Trump warriors followed him. At the White House, Trump was back in his private dining room watching everything unfold on television. Aides, including Dan Scavino and Kayleigh McEnany, popped in and out. The president was riveted. His supporters had heeded his call to march on the Capitol with pride and boldness. For Trump, there was no more beautiful sight than thousands of energetic people waving Trump flags, wearing red MAGA caps, and fighting to keep him in power. He thought, this is cool. He was happy, recalled one aide who was with Trump that afternoon. Then, when it turned violent, he thought, oh, crap. As rioters marauded through the Capitol, it was clear whom they were looking for. Some of them shouted, hang Mike Pence. Trump didn't exactly throw them off the hunt. At 2:24 p.m., the president tweeted, Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution. Back at the White House, Keith Kellogg, the vice president's national security advisor, was worried about Pence's safety and went to find Trump. Is Mike okay? The president asked him. The Secret Service has him under control, Kellogg told Trump. Karen is there with the daughter. Oh, Trump asked. They're going to stay there until this thing gets sorted out, Kellogg said. Trump said nothing more. He didn't express any hope that Pence was okay. He didn't try to call the vice president to check on him. He just stayed in the dining room watching television. We should mention this account has not been independently confirmed by NBC News. Let's bring in NBC News and MSNBC national affairs analyst, host and executive producer of Showtime's The Circus and host of the Hell and High Water podcast from The Recount, John Heilman. New York Times reporter and MSNBC national security analyst, Michael Schmidt. And Casey Hunt joins us as well. Casey, we heard your announcement this morning. I've known about it. I'm practicing some radical acceptance right now, and it is not working. I've been with you on this journey, and so it's a dialectical. I can't accept it, and I'm really proud of you. So we'll talk more about this later. Michael Schmidt and John Heilman. Heilman, I'll go to you first. We can all talk to Casey a little bit more about this, but Heilman, the quotes from the book, and the lack of any care for his vice president. It starts right there. What are your reactions?
Well, hey, good morning, Mika. And, you know, it's been a really, this has been a you know, this period of the last week or two when we started to see these inside accounts. This is the one that we're focusing on this morning, the Rucker and Carol Lenig, is just the last couple of days have provided, you know, an incredible amount of fodder. Almost all of it, in some sense, confirming and making vivid and making real a lot of things that were that we all kind of felt in our guts or we knew through some reporting and we saw some contemporaneous reporting. But these guys have gone so deep now into really kind of putting flesh on the bones to just how what a perilous moment it was for the country and just how dangerous Donald Trump was. Those are the big headlines here, it seems to me, whether you talk about the reporting from this same book yesterday about the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and his concerns about a Reichstag moment. And now the ones from the excerpt this morning, you know, it almost as staggering, Mika, as Trump's total lack of care for Mike Pence. And again, we sort of knew he was tweeting, attacking Pence at the moment when Pence was in physical mortal danger. And we talked about this on the show in real time or shortly thereafter. But almost as stunning as that in this excerpt is another fact that we basically knew, but really comes through blaringly, which is, where is Donald Trump commander in chief? Where is Donald Trump in the residence on the phone talking to military leaders, talking to the National Guard, talking to anyone where he could be of assistance in trying to quell this violence as it was unfolding? Instead, he's passive, and both on some levels we see enjoying the sight of his minions acting with what he would consider strength, and on the other side, kind of acting with total human disregard for his completely loyal vice president for 4 years, but just so completely disengaged from the most fundamental constitutional obligation that he had at that point for another 16 days, which was, you know, to protect the United States of America against enemies foreign and domestic. Here, the country, the capital was under siege by enemies who were domestic, and Donald Trump is doing nothing, if anything, making the situation worse.
All right. John mentioned part of the book that we told you about yesterday of Joint Chief Chairman Mark Milley's concerns about a possible coup by former President Trump and his allies after the 2020 election. Yesterday, Trump put out a statement in response to those revelations, writing, quote, "I never threatened or spoke about to anyone a coup of our government. So ridiculous. Sorry to inform you, but an election is my form of coup. And if I was going to do a coup, one of the last people I would want to do it with is General Mark Milley, Michael Schmidt." Here we go again. At the same time, this is a really, really dangerous moment for our country, that there isn't a uniform, just absolute agreement that there was a man in charge who incited a riot against our U.S. Capitol, our Constitution, our democracy in process. How much does this match a lot of the reporting that you've been doing?
And that was like sort of a classic Trump response there as a way of, you know, taking a shot at Milley and also sort of, you know, throwing himself into this discussion about the coup in the way that he did. It flashbacks of sort of the Trump tweets. Look, all of these accounts are really stark and really scary because we saw, all of us, how close we came to the edge and what that insurrection was and how that was such a manifestation of everything that Donald Trump had done over 4 years. What I keep on finding that I think we sometimes forget or miss is that a lot of these people who, you know, found themselves in dangerous places like Mike Pence or, you know, others, were people that for 4 years had been around Donald Trump and knew about his possibilities. They were enablers of Donald Trump. Mike Pence helped Donald Trump get out of the Mueller investigation. Mike Pence stood around silently many times over the 4 years that Donald Trump was president, and didn't say much and didn't do much to hold the president accountable. You know, there's accounts of Bill Barr that have come out about, you know, different things that Bill Barr did or said. There was no greater enabler of Donald Trump than Bill Barr. So I understand the importance that these individuals played in the historic moments after the election and how the country was on its edge. But these were folks that were still there after 4 years of Donald Trump being president. These were people that had seen the president act up close. I guess some of them thought they needed to be there to stop Trump from hurting himself and hurting the country. And I understand the unusualness of that phenomena. But, you know, at the same time, you know, I don't think many of us were surprised by Donald Trump's behavior after the election.
And Casey, right in the middle of this week when we're getting these breathtaking excerpts from Carol Lenning and Phil Rucker's book about what happened leading up to January 6th, what happened on that day and what happened afterward, you would think it might give some Republicans pause. And yet the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, yesterday was at Bedminster, President Trump's golf club, meeting with him, kissing the ring, even as we're hearing these stories. And even as just on Sunday at CPAC, former President Trump said what we saw in those images was a group of patriots, that they were peaceful. And in his words on January 6th, love was in the air. So full denial from Donald Trump, full denial from Republicans, and even the leadership of the Republican Party still going to make sure they still have Donald Trump in their pocket.
Yeah, it continues to be stunning, Willie, for sure. And of course, while the official accounts of the meeting yesterday between McCarthy and Trump say that they didn't talk about selections for the January 6th special committee that's going to look into this, we know that McCarthy has been involved in the decision-making process there, and there's been this sense on the Hill that under no circumstances is he going to select those people without making sure that the former president is on board with what he does here. And you know, I would just underscore a couple things. I mean, first of all, we've learned so much from these accounts, but there is also a lot that we don't know because we have reporting, contemporaneous reporting from that day about, for example, the call that we know occurred between the president and Kevin McCarthy. There are a lot of questions about what was said there. Who else was calling the president? I know Democrats are very interested in getting copies of the president's phone records. Whether that's going to be possible is an entirely different question. Democrats are going to meet with the Department of Justice, which, of course, has been investigating the riot itself to see what kind of evidence they can get their hands on. That'll tell us a lot about that day. And just to circle back to Mike Pence, and as he's in the Capitol, and there is eventually an angry phone call from Pence to the White House, he's huddled in this room, and the only person that can call off these people is the former president, Donald Trump. And one of the most evocative pieces of evidence we have for this is I did an interview with a Capitol police officer who was in one of those doorways, who was injured by the mob, had to take several weeks off of work. And he said he was as he was confronting these rioters who were trying to push past him and get into the Capitol, he said, come on, like, you have to listen to me. And they said back to him, we're here because President Trump told us to be here. He's the only one we listen to. We don't listen to the police. We don't listen to law enforcement. We listen to President Trump. That's why we're here. Mm-hmm. And that shows you the importance of what Trump himself was going to say and do on that day. That's why the tweet that he sent out seemed so half-hearted and people were so disappointed by it, because he was, again, the only one that had the power to actually say, OK, I'm going to keep Mike Pence and all these other people safe. So that's what the stakes were.
So, I mean, this really shows what Casey's analysis shows us is the need for robust hearings, looking into every aspect of this. Because I want to focus on something Casey said, Trump being the only person who could have really called this off, John Heilman. It's just like so many of those people who were there and so many people across America, Trump is the only person who could inspire them to get the vaccine. And yet he doesn't. And therein lies the cult-likeness of the Trump following that is such a danger to our democracy. It's not an exaggeration. This is how cult leaders act.
Yes,
And I will go back to something Willie said a second ago, Mika, to answer that question. Then I want to ask Mike Schmidt a question growing out of this. But, you know, Willie said that the Republican Party and Donald Trump were in full denial about what happened on January 6th. But he cited something that is much worse. And this goes to the cult leader point. You know, what Trump is now doing is something much, much more insidious and much more dangerous than being in denial. It was bad enough when Trump and others were saying that this was just that these are all happy revelers and it was a atmosphere of a picnic and they were just like normal Capitol visitors, like trying to memory hole what happened on January 6th, even though we all saw it with our own eyes, even though we all can watch the 30-minute reconstruction that Mike's colleagues at the New York Times did in video. It's all out there, right? And here are the Republican Party collectively led by Trump trying to whitewash it, but they're not trying to whitewash it anymore. Trump is now trying to turn this into a glorious moment of patriotism. He's now trying to do a full Orwellian inversion. And, you know, the whole thing of now trying to turn Ashley Babbitt into a martyr is another part of that. That is going in a much more, I mean, the memory holding is dangerous, is incredibly dangerous to the country when you have tens of millions of Republicans who believe the election was illegitimate. But to try to characterize this as a glorious moment, a righteous moment, is a 10 times worse. And it leads me, Mike, to this question, right? Because it connects up to this other thing, which is this moment after the election from November 7th all the way through to January 6th. You know, if on this program and other places, when people would express the view that we were worried about what Donald Trump might be doing at the Pentagon with his personnel changes, was he going to try to deploy the military for some political purpose? Was he going to try to hold on to power? If you had said the word coup, on Morning Joe, the entire Republican Party would come down in your head and say you are a lunatic, Trump derangement syndrome driven maniac who's fantasizing, paranoid, all of that, right? Now we have learned that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs was not just contemplating the possibility of a coup or Donald Trump trying to seize control of the military for his personal or political ends to try to extend his time in office. He was not just thinking those things. He was taking action on a daily basis on the presumption that that was where Trump was headed. And I guess the question I have to ask it's crazy to even ask now whether the Republicans have any shame, but it is amazing to me that in this moment, as Mark Milley is revealed as having fought these things, done the things he did, along with Mike Pompeo and others in real time, that there is no collective institutional grappling with that reality by Republicans. Is there not ever going to be a moment where someone on the Republican side looks up and says, yeah, you know what? We were wrong. And all of you who were most alarmed were in fact right.
I don't think so, especially because, as you were pointing out, the Republican Party has continued to follow Trump in this direction. There has not been any introspection. And those people who have wanted to look back, the Liz Cheneys of the world, have been ridiculed and exiled and shunned by the party. And the party has just continued to move in that Trump direction, even as Trump has seen his own approval ratings and his own popularity begin to wane. And there's sort of been a disconnect there in terms of, you know, why is it that the Republican Party is continuing to follow him even if Trump's popularity is falling off? And I don't know if there will ever be anything that sort of changes the minds of this part of this bedrock part of the Republican Party led by Leader McCarthy about how they view Trump. Obviously, McCarthy still sees him as sort of a gatekeeper. They have followed what he wants in regards to this panel, this special committee that has been appointed to look at the events. You know, it seems like they obviously don't want to go along with it, and they may want to put people on the panel that are going to be obstructionists to the entire thing. And I think that the one thing that when you step back from all of it, whether it was the president plotting coups or the president's attempts to undermine the election or the president's attempts to, you know, throw sand in the gears of investigations, is that the president was very ham-handed in a lot of what he did. The president knew how to get out the megaphone and to yell and say things. But when it came to being a tactician and actually getting down and plotting the coup or truly obstructing justice, he was only so skilled, and that prevented him from doing even more damage.
All right, Michael Schmidt, thank you so much for your reporting this morning. And coming up on Morning Joe.
To quote our dear friend, former senator and current President Joe Biden, this is a big effing deal. One of the biggest effing deals that's been passed in decades and decades.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer celebrates the expanded child tax credit and sets up a new deadline for an infrastructure deal. Also ahead this morning.
They're storing wheelchairs and other equipment in the hallways because there's just no place else to put them. Every single room in this hospital is full, every single one, except for this one. They plan on bringing in someone here from the ER any minute now.
Nope, that's not from months and months ago. That's from yesterday. As we mentioned, coronavirus cases are on the rise. NBC's Gabe Gutierrez has a look at one hospital in Arkansas where doctors are struggling to keep up with the surge in patients. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
As we've been discussing this morning, COVID cases are rising across the country. Hospitals are filling up, including at one in Little Rock, Arkansas. Gabe Gutierrez has the story.
In Little Rock, Arkansas, you not only hear, but see the surge.
You hit the floor running, and most all of us are working extra hours.
This is one of four COVID units at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. Nurse Mary Alice Luce is exhausted.
These patients are definitely sicker. Like, we see really, really sick patients.
And younger ones, 20 to 40 years old, as well as pregnant women. Overall, Arkansas has seen a 130% jump in cases over the last 2 weeks.
They're storing wheelchairs and other equipment in the hallways because there's just no place else to put them. Every single room in this hospital is full, every single one, except for this one. They plan on bringing in someone here from the ER any minute now.
I'm very worried about back to school. I'm very concerned about continuing strain on our healthcare system.
How much does it frustrate you that the vaccination issue has become politicized?
It's disheartening.
At one of the hospital's vaccine clinics nearby, 600 doses are available each day. Just 19 people made appointments. The overall vaccination rate here is only about 35%.
Were you skeptical of getting the vaccine?
Yes.
Why is that?
Because it was not proven yet.
Tate Ezzy and his wife did not get the shot. In May, the couple and four of their five kids tested positive for COVID. Tate was hospitalized. So was his wife.
Just kind of turned our world upside down.
They texted each other from separate rooms until she was placed on a ventilator, all the more terrifying because she was pregnant.
We lost the baby, and at some point her oxygen had just dropped too low.
His wife survived and is now in rehab. To him, COVID is far from over.
I want other people to hear my story so maybe they will think twice about not getting vaccinated.
Gabe Gutierrez reporting for us there. From Arkansas, we move east to Mississippi, the state with one of the lowest vaccination rates in the country and where hospitalizations are on the rise. Doctors there say vaccines are available, but they too are struggling with misinformation.
Sometimes I feel like the voices of science and medicine are drowned out by the, you know, Facebook experts. But there are many voices out there saying this is the right thing to do. This is what we need to do. The vaccine is safe, but sometimes I feel like we're outnumbered.
There's been a sharp increase in children hospitalized with severe cases. More than half a dozen children are in the ICU because of the virus in the state of Mississippi. Two of them had to be put on a ventilator. Mika, again, there's no mystery here. God. Vaccinations. The lowest rates tied are Mississippi and Arkansas, the two states we just talked about, hovering around 33 to 35%. Alabama also in that range. As Dr. Patel just said it and can't be any more clear about it, if people get vaccinated, we avoid scenes like the ones we just showed.
It's a resurgence, but solely among the unvaccinated. And the patients, as we just heard, are younger, sicker, and virtually all unvaccinated. Joining us now is the reporter who spoke to the doctor we just heard from, NBC News correspondent Ellison Barber. She's live at the state's only children's hospital in Jackson, Mississippi. Ellison, what can you tell us specifically about children who have gotten severely ill from COVID?
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about children here, and when you're looking at numbers in general in this state, on the surface, they might not seem particularly high, right? There were 557 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Mississippi yesterday, but it is the rate that they are rising that is really concerning. When you look further at the numbers, hospitalizations in this state because of COVID-19 have steadily increased since the beginning of this month. And in the last week and a half alone, COVID patients in ICUs, that number has nearly doubled. When you look specifically at children, Mississippi's top health official had talked about and put out these numbers earlier in the week, warning people that the Delta variant, which makes up about 80% of their cases here, is really serious and impacting children right now. And the reason why they're putting out that number is because when you look at the amount of people who are hospitalized because of COVID-19, children are making up a staggering percentage of it compared to where they were last year. That number, 7 children in ICUs because of COVID-19 statewide, that means that children currently make up 7% of the COVID patients hospitalized in intensive care units because of COVID-19. When I spoke to doctors at this hospital, they have 5 children here right now. They told me that that percent increase is what's really troubling, because that is not the high percentage, as high of a percentage. It is higher, rather, a percentage right now of children hospitalized because of COVID-19 than they saw at their peak in the summer last year. Guys.
You know, I recognize that people don't like being told what to do, but we also, as a society, are told what to do for a lot of things. You know, we pay taxes. We have to get vaccines before we go to school. We have to get car tags. So there are a lot of things that we're used to doing because we know we have to do. And this, to me, is more about responsibility for society.
We've certainly seen complications of COVID-19 and very critical children with COVID-19 and very critical young adults and late teens with COVID-19 and people who have died who would have been, you know, well if they had not gotten it. It's a very preventable disease with this vaccine.
And Ellison, I mean, these are great interviews, and it's really framing the point that a lot of people, public health experts, are trying to make at this point. We've been doing vaccines for 70 years. And I just wonder, what are you hearing about what's behind this severe hesitancy? Hesitancy that is leading to a pandemic among the unvaccinated in this country.
You know, I've spoken in the last couple of weeks to people who are unvaccinated in Mississippi and also in Alabama. I actually went in Alabama to the county that is the least vaccinated in the state. And the range of answers we heard for why people weren't getting vaccinated ranged from outright conspiracy theories to skepticism. But here, what I keep hearing from doctors, particularly in this state, is that they really do feel like, and you heard Dr. Woodward say it at the beginning of this segment, that they are competing against Facebook post, and they can't really match that rate as much as they try of misinformation, and that a lot of people are, for whatever reason, choosing to rely on things they see on Facebook instead of their doctors here. And one of the things one of the doctors at this hospital told me is that it's so frustrating because people trust them to give advice for their children, to tell them what other vaccines to get, to treat cancer, to save lives constantly. But on this, for whatever reason, they are choosing to trust Facebook posts instead of the doctors here who are consistently saying, we need you to get vaccinated in order to save lives, in order to keep our hospitals at a capacity level where we can treat anything that people might need care for. And they keep running into a wall in this state again and again. And I asked them, I said, is there something the federal government could be doing here to help more? Do you need more from the state? And they said, the issue here is that vaccines are widely available. Anyone can get them anywhere in this state if they want to. But people are not doing it. And so they are literally begging people to do something and do something about this now, because with the Delta variant, they say right now we're in a position where the vaccines actually deal with that variant. But the more it spreads, the more variants we'll get. And the vaccines we have right now, they might not work down the road. Mika.
My God. NBC's Ellison Barber live in Mississippi. Thank you so much. And we will speak with the U.S. Surgeon General just ahead. Morning Joe is coming right back.
These are Mississippians. We live here. We love this state. Our families are here, and they are saying, please get vaccinated. And it is like we are yelling into a void. They trust us for so many things, but there is just this big disconnect and blind spot around the vaccine that to me, I cannot reconcile rational thought with that.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable, high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
Welcome back to Morning Joe. Millions of parents are receiving their first monthly check from the government. President Biden hailing the one-year expanded child tax credit as a major step toward ending child poverty in America. Here's NBC News Chief White House Correspondent Peter Alexander.
Badly needed relief for Sasha Dembski in Arkansas. The single mother of three, including a nine-year-old daughter, Zoe, was laid off while she was hospitalized with COVID this spring.
What does that money mean to you and your family?
It means a lot. I've always lived paycheck to paycheck, and so it will continue to be helpful and keep us going.
The child tax credit payments begin showing up in checking accounts today, up to $300 a month for each child five and under, $250 each month for children 6 to 17. It applies to single parents earning as much as $112,000 a year and couples making up to $150,000. Families that don't make enough to pay taxes can register to receive their check.
This is the right thing to do, and it's a smart thing to do.
The new program expands on the existing child tax credit and was added as part of the COVID relief package earlier this year. Some Republicans have criticized the program as welfare because it removes work requirements to receive the money. Sasha says she hopes they make the one-year program permanent.
We've got billionaires going to space, but we still have people down here trying to make ends meet.
All right. Casey Hahn, I want to ask you about these payments, a tax credit, as it's called, compared to everything else that Democrats are trying to push through at this point. How is it working with the, you know, bipartisan efforts that are underway? And are Democrats and Republicans able to agree to disagree on some of these measures?
Well, Mika, what's different about this is it's a credit, yes, but it's being sent in advance. So instead of being another line item on, you know, your giant tax return, it's showing up as money in people's bank accounts right now. And that's a really important difference because people are actually going to see it and understand something about these complicated policy questions that we're always talking about. And this has been something that Republicans and Democrats have in the past been willing to agree on. I mean, a lot of Republicans support an expanded child tax credit. But of course, actually making this something that happens again and again is going to be tricky. And reporter for The Washington Post, Eugene Scott, joins us now. And Eugene, let me bring you in on this, because this is going to be a key part of what the Democrats are going to try to do in their major reconciliation plan. They want to make to extend the child tax credit and make it work in this different way. It is really hard to see any way in which this is not just a pure political win, especially for a White House that, you know, campaigned on this kind of policy change and is now going to likely see potentially benefits from those independent swing voters that they're going to need to hang on to in the midterms. And that, of course, is focusing on the politics, not even the policy, which is going to help so many families.
Absolutely. And this is going to be popular because, as you've noted before, there are going to be people receiving these tax credits on both sides of the aisle. The reality is that poverty and eliminating it for children is something that is winsome to voters, regardless of their political persuasion. And I was interviewing educators yesterday who were talking about the Biden administration trying to make a strong correlation between, obviously, child hunger and students' abilities to perform academically. And there's a lot of attention on how well students are going to be this fall as so many schools attempt to get back to normal. And so adjusting to the mental health challenges, adjusting to the poverty challenges, adjusting to child hunger are all of these things that the Biden administration has said that they're trying to pay attention to with the hope of winning support from people across the political spectrum.
You know, John Heilman, as we talk about all this massive legislation, we're just casually throwing around trillion-dollar figures when we talk about infrastructure, $3.5 trillion, add in the bipartisan bill, you get up over $4 trillion. You've got voting rights, and Joe Manchin is at the center of it. And again, talk about whether or not the filibuster is going to stay in place. He's been pretty clear, as has been Senator Sinema of Arizona, they don't want to move the filibuster. They don't want to eliminate the filibuster, which leaves Democrats wondering how they get all this stuff through without reconciliation, at least on the budget stuff.
Yeah, it's a big sprawling thing, Willie. And, you know, there's obviously been some indication on Manchin's part that maybe he's not going to get rid of the filibuster. There's no question about that. But is there some potential openness to filibuster reform, bringing back the talking filibuster? Those are all things people talk about. But I think that, like, the macro picture here is just, you know, the sweeping ambition of Joe Biden, the sweeping ambition of Democrats who see a lot of need out in the country, also see an opportunity to have unified control, however narrow, the 50-50 Senate, the very small majority in the House, and a very limited amount of time to have it. You know, you're going to be headed into midterm campaigning just a few months from now. So it's like you're looking basically down the path here. You've got a few months between now and the end of this year into early next year to try to do all the things you just talked about. And the appetite for it on the Democratic side is very high, but the days are very limited, and the hurdles are also very high. So we're going to see it's really going to be crunch time. The fact that they're working this much this summer tells you something about it, but we're going to really see a very high degree of legislative difficulty and a lot of pressure and a lot of intensity on Capitol Hill over the course of the months to come, because really once you turn the corner into 2022, it's going to very quickly become all politics all the time.
Yeah. Another story we've been following all week is the Democratic lawmakers that left the state of Texas in order not to have a vote on voting rights laws that tend to be extreme. And Eugene Scott, I'm wondering, some of those Democrats met with Joe Manchin yesterday. Where does he stand on this? What is his role? And what's next for these Democratic lawmakers who've literally left the state so there is no quorum?
Well, as you know, these lawmakers were hoping that the senator would support federal voting legislation that could make what Republicans in the state of Texas are trying to do obsolete. Manchin's made it clear that he wanted to hear them out, but he's given no suggestion that he was going to change what it is that he believes that his constituents want him to do when it comes to voting rights. And that is not, you know, protest the filibuster. And I'm not surprised to hear that, given what he has written in the Washington Post and said repeatedly in interviews up until this point. He is very aware that, you know, many of the people who support him are conservatives and do not support what he believes is to be an extreme and too liberal approach to voting rights acts, to voting rights. So regardless of what those in Texas say and those outside of his state say, his priority is going to continue to be those people that elected him.
All right, Eugene Scott from The Washington Post, thank you very much. John Heilman, thank you as well.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.